This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome along. My name's Dan. It's time to actually use your brain for once. This is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thanks for giving us a listen. This week, on the only show that zooms you all around the universe and gets you back home where no one's noticed, in about 30 minutes, we'll learn about one of the most dangerous plants in the world. Also, we'll talk about a killer shrimp. I'll say that one more time. It's two words that you never expect to find next to each other. A killer shrimp. And you can hear how you can help save a species. Also, I've got some more of your questions to answer that you've left over on Apple Podcasts. Today, the questions are all about stomachs, electricity, and legs. Stay there. I'll explain more after we catch up with one of our favourite geniuses here on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It's Professor Hallux.
Hallux's Hydration Help Desk. Call accepted.
Hello, Professor. Mum says that I should drink a glass of water when I wake up and before I go to bed. Is that right?
Ah, good points raised there. You lose water in your sleep by breathing and sweating, so it's a good idea to have water beside your bed so that you can have a drink as soon as you wake up in the morning, or if you wake up during the night. Drinking water in the morning hydrates your body and gives you a good start to the day. And it's also good to have a drink before you go to bed. Whilst you're sleeping, your body is still hard at work. Having a drink will help it restore fluids lost during the day. There's also more time for the water to reach every part of your body and replenish nutrients, vitamins and minerals where they're needed.
The water will also help clean out your body whilst you're sleeping. During the day, your body collects toxins from the environment, food and other elements. Cleaning out these toxins helps keep your body healthy, and you'll wake up with an extra boost of energy.
But don't forget to go to the toilet before you go to bed. Nothing worse than a midnight walk to the bathroom. Don't forget that you need to drink regularly across the day. A child's body has a larger surface area in comparison to their body weights than adults, and so you lose more water from your skin. So as well as when you wake up, you should remember to have a glass of water with breakfast, during the morning, with your lunch, gradually over the afternoon, when you get home from school, or from playing with friends, and with your dinner. Any other top tips, Nanobot?
Whatever sport you're doing, whether intense or gentle, you lose water. Even a game of hide and seek can make you sweat. So don't let yourself get dehydrated. Water helps transport minerals, which your muscles rely on around your body in the blood. You'll always see athletes having a drink of water before, during, and after training.
Good points there, Nanobot. So remember to always carry a bottle of water with you and drink some water before you leave. That way, you're making up for the water you'll lose when you sweat before you've even started.
Hallux's Hydration Help Desk, with support from the Children's Health Fund. Find out more at funkidslive.com/hallux.
If you've got a science question rattling around your brain that you really need the answer to, I can do that. No worries. I'll do all the research for you and everything. Just leave it as a review for the show over on Apple Podcasts. Open it up, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, drop us 5 stars, leave your name so I can say hello. There's a little comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question, just like this from Ada, who is 19. Hey, Ada, thanks for listening. They say, why do stomachs rumble? Now, Ada, it's usually to do with the movement of food, gas and fluid as it moves through the small intestine on its way out of your body, if you kind of know what I mean. The reason that our stomachs rumble and growl is because it's when that's moving. And why it rumbles and growls more when you're hungry is because our stomachs are empty, so there's nothing in there to muffle the noise. It's kind of echoing around your belly. Thanks for that, Ada. This is from Rue as well. Rue asks, what is electricity? Well, it's quite tough to explain like this, Rue, but I'll give it my best shot. Electricity is the movement of charged particles. You see, everything in the whole world is made up of particles, and electricity is the flow of these particles when they're negatively charged, and they're called electrons. And this flow of electrons helps power things. It helps motors to spin. It helps something get hot, like a toaster. And it travels all around your house through wires. the wires that contain electricity are full of metal, and they've got loose electrons inside them. And the power pushes the electrons through the wires in the right direction. You get alternating current, AC, or direct current, DC, and that determines in which way the electrons are moving and how fast they're moving. It's quite a complex idea. I think I've done it quite well, and I hope I've made it slightly simple. It's really tough. But Roo, thanks for the question. And lastly, this is from Science Ibby on Apple Podcasts, who asks why we only have two legs. Well, Ibby, no one really knows, to be honest. It's something that happens millions and millions of years ago, but they think it's all down to evolution, which is survival of the fittest, where bodies become more adapted to make the best of their environment, and they are the species that then lives and becomes the best. And having two legs back in the day freed our hands for carrying and working with tools, and it also let us walk for long distance and then finally start running, which ultimately has helped us become the superior species. Thank you so much for the question. If you've got something that you need answering, leave it for me as a review over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, some animal experts are calling on you to help save a species. The People's Trust for Endangered Species, they need your help with stag beetles. Laura Bauer is a conservation officer at PTES, and she can tell us how we can help. Hey, Laura.
Hello.
Now, this is going to sound quite a mean question to start. We're told to help save so many species all the time. Yep. Pandas, bees. Why should stag beetles go quite high up the list?
Well, I think every species is important in its own right, but particularly stag beetles, because they occur in our gardens, and we can actually do something about it. And they're actually performing a little bit of a service for us. So the larvae live underground for several years, feeding on dead wood, and they actually return nutrients back into the soil for us. So they're actually really good for us.
Now, again, this is going to sound mean, but stag beetles are a notoriously ugly-looking creature, I want to say. I mean, they don't look like nice and sweet and cute.
I would say magnificent. they have got these fearsome-looking jaws, which the males use for wrestling and fighting each other over females. But they're actually harmless to humans, so we shouldn't worry.
We know that we need to save the stag beetle, Laura, but how do we know that? What studies, what research have PTES done that's let you know that maybe it needs our help?
Okay, so we know that it's gone extinct in several countries across Europe. It's actually doing quite well here in Britain. The People's Trust for Endangered Species has been monitoring where beetles occur for the last 20 years now, and the range, i.e. where they live, is quite stable over that time. But we don't actually know about the numbers, so we're still quite concerned.
We said earlier that the stag beetle is quite a menacing-looking beast. What kind of creatures feast on the stag beetle? Who are its main predators?
So it sort of has different predators. As a larva, it might get dug up by foxes or badgers because it's a nice, tasty treat for them. Once it emerges as an adult, it starts to fly around, but it's not hugely quick and it can't get away. So it gets eaten by things like magpies and crows. It also gets crushed underfoot sometimes by people and run over on the road. They're actually attracted to the warm tarmac, so it's a bit unfortunate really, but they can get run over. And then once one gets run over, they can also attract other beetles, which then means more and more get run over.
Oh, it's a vicious circle.
It is.
So, you know, aside from, and don't do this, but aside from standing next to the road and making sure they're not going onto the hot tarmac, how can we actually help the stag beetle? I know over at PTES, you've got a few ideas of what we can do over the summer.
Yeah, so really, I mean, predators and things like that are natural anyway. It's only when a species is in trouble that we really need to worry about predators and things. So what we can do is report stag beetles when we see them. That would be really helpful. But also in your gardens and schools, you can build log piles. So stag beetles actually need decaying wood that's underneath the ground. So you need to bury some of that wood. We actually use the term log pyramid. So it kind of stands up and looks kind of like a building almost. So you dig a hole, bury the logs in upright, and then fill in the holes. So there's still some of the wood above the surface, but there's lots of wood underneath. They also like wood chips as well. So any gardens that have got wood chippings covering them, that's really useful too.
Once I've done all this, once I've made them almost like a little den in my back garden, if I see one of them, what should I do? Should I go over and investigate? Should I stand well back? What's the general idea?
Well, enjoy watching it. They're not, you know, afraid of us, as it were. So, you know, get close if you want to see it. But then just leave it alone, really, unless it's in danger. So the main thing, you know, you can do is if it's on a road and you're able to, or if it's about to be eaten by a magpie or a crow, you can chase the magpie or crow away. Sometimes dogs and cats get interested. So if you could keep your pets inside just on warm evenings, it's, they're only about during June and July. So, you know, you're hardly likely to see one, but you'll be really lucky if you do.
Now, I know that right now you're focused on stag beetles, but Laura, what other endangered species are capturing your eye, the ones that we could help if we had the time?
Yeah, well, another one that we're focusing on is hedgehogs, because they are widespread across the UK and they are in gardens. And you can do stuff in your garden to help them as well. Make sure you've got wild areas. If you're encouraging insects, then that's good for hedgehogs too, because that's what they eat. And also to link up your gardens with your neighbours, because hedgehogs need a, you know, quite a wide range to roam across to find food. So if we think of the size of our garden, we also need to let it through to the next garden and the next garden. So walls and fences are actually barriers to them.
You said hedgehogs, and it reminds me of earlier when you said about the stag beetles liking the hot tarmac on a road.
Yeah.
And it makes you think about the hedgehog, in that a lot of creatures that have been around, you know, that are wild in nature, they're not, we've not made things easy for them, because hedgehogs, they stumble onto a road and when they panic, they roll up into a ball and they don't move anywhere.
Yeah, and they can often get run over.
Road's not a brilliant place for you to stay in a ball, is it? So we need to do as much help as we can. You're doing the great stag hunt. If you're listening, if you see a stag beetle when you've given them all this help in your back garden, you want to get involved with the great stag hunt, get online, record your sighting. It's ptes.org/GSH, great stag hunt. Laura, thank you so much for coming on the Science Weekly to tell us more.
Thank you.
For this week's Dangerous Dan, we're talking about one of the most mean and deadly plants in the world. Before we get stuck into it, this is pretty cool. Its proper Latin name comes from women in the Middle Ages who would rub the juice of the plant into their eyes to make them large and stunning and intoxicating. They'd be called a beautiful lady, which translates to Atropa Belladonna, otherwise known as Deadly Nightshade. It ranks amongst the most poisonous plants in Europe. All parts of Deadly Nightshade are toxic. Part of it is a wide pinkish purpley flower, and it's got a small dark cherry-like fruit that's attached to it. Now, eating just a handful of these can kill an adult, and you need to stay away, because just one or two drops of Deadly Nightshade would kill you. It would see you off. Symptoms include red face, dry mouth, wide pupils. Before your heart starts to beat frantically all over the place, you'll hallucinate, you'll get paranoid, and then finally, you'll die. Throughout history, people have always known the deathly potential of deadly nightshade. They'd use it in poisons, just a few drops into drinks of someone that they didn't want to be there. Also, they'd put it on the edge of poisonous arrows, a blunt, toxic tip. And rumour is, back in the day, witches would use deadly nightshade. And if it's good enough for a witch, it's deadly enough to be on our Dangerous Dan list. Deadly nightshade goes straight near the top.
Hello there, I'm George, and I'm here to tell you all about the Fun Kids Download. It's a podcast you can get from wherever you get your podcasts. This week, I'm joined by animation royalty, not actual royalty, but the stars of How to Train Your Dragon 3, plus author Anne-Marie Howe, who's chatting about her brand new book. If you're lucky, you might even get a yes-no game. That is the Fun Kids Download. Get it from wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get a lesson from the smartest school outside of the solar system, Deep Space High, and catch up with Professor Pulsar.
Deep Space High, spaceports.
Okay, everyone at Deep Space High, I'm ready to transmit my presentation on spaceports. You're gonna love it. Transmitting in 3, 2, 1. It's exciting that there's going to be spaceports in the UK. We could have them within the next 5 years, helping to launch satellites and send supplies to the International Space Station. And you know, in time, maybe people like you and me will fly from them into space. How cool would that be? At the moment, when a European space company wants to send a payload into space, it has to send them a long way, even as far as Brazil and Australia. So just think, how much time and money could be saved by only having to move a payload a few miles to the nearest spaceport? Now, as much as I'd love to have a spaceport in my town, that's probably not going to happen. If you think about it, airports are often a little way outside of the areas where people live, and it's not hard to see why. Not everyone wants to live under a flight path. And it's safer if planes are taking off and landing where there's plenty of space. It's the same to spacecrafts and rockets. In fact, even more so. Spacecraft carry a lot more fuel than aeroplanes, and so to maximise safety, it would be good if they were a long way from where people live or work. And it's not just for the launch, but also as they begin their ascent, especially as some types of spacecraft have fuel tanks which detach as they climb. So, where might be a good place for some spaceports in the UK? Well, there's already a short list of places. First up, Cornwall. Now, Cornwall gets me thinking about paddling in the coves and eating ice cream on the beach. And it's actually the sea that makes Cornwall an attractive choice for a spaceport. Spacecraft would be able to launch over the sea and travel into the atmosphere without going over land on its way. There's already an airport in Cornwall which has a very long runway, so it's a strong contender. Another possible location is Lossiemouth in Scotland. Like Cornwall, it's right on the coast and already has a very long runway, which is used by the RAF, so they're used to a bit of noise. And even further north, there's Unst, the most northern island in the Shetlands. It's so far north that rockets lifting off from the island could fly straight into orbit without passing over any populated areas. Whilst being in remote locations is great for safety, it's a bit tricky to get to them, especially if you're aiming at space tourism. More railways or road might need to be built to help us get there, or even more airlinks if you're going all that way to Unst. And you need to think about the people who work at the spaceports and at the high-tech support business that will grow around them. Planners will need to think about where they'll live and how they'll travel to work. If we use airports that already exist, then we're ahead of the game with a lot of these problems. Another factor that will affect location is the weather. Operating space flights when it's overcast and with strong crosswinds could be dangerous. If not, just annoying for passengers wishing to see the Earth from space. So, what the weather is like in different areas will affect where we place our spaceports. Uh-oh, losing the connection. Catch you next time.
Deep Space High. Spaceports. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
It's time for this week's Science in the News. A killer shrimp has reached UK rivers and it could be altering how other creatures behave through fear alone. The simple presence of this alien crustacean, this shrimp from another part of the world, can stop other species in the river from doing simple jobs that it does every day just because they're so scared. It's a killer shrimp and it's found its way from home here to Europe. Also, a robotic boat and submersible have won a prize to find the best new tech to map the seafloor. It's called the SeaKit MaxLimmer. It's been put together by the International Jebco NF team. The robots they've made won the Shell Ocean Discover X prize, and hopefully they'll now dive under the sea using state-of-the-art technology to learn more about the very bottom of the ocean. And finally, rare snow has swept across eastern Australia, the first time it's got this icy for years. Severe weather warnings have been issued with snow, heavy rain and gale force winds battering parts of Queensland. Now, usually it's a boiling hot subtropical climate, but places along the 1,000 kilometre stretch of coast have recorded freezing cold temperatures and winds of almost 100 kilometres an hour. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. If things that you've heard today have got things stirring in your brain, if it's dragged up something that you heard at school a while ago that you forgot about because it just sounded ridiculous and you thought, well, that can't be true, you can find out if it is on the show. All you need to do is find the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review, give us 5 stars, write your name so I can say hello. There's a comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. I will find the answer for you. Also, while you're on Apple Podcasts, it's one of the best places that you can hear all of the Fun Kids series that we do. You've heard some today. There's loads more that you can catch up on. And they're also wherever you hear your shows. You know, places like Spotify, Google Podcasts. You can find it on the Fun Kids app, and it's at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids are a children's radio in the UK. You can hear us all around the country on your DAB digital radio on that Fun Kids app. And as always, at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.